You're listening to The Philosopher's Note on Outlive. More wisdom in less time.
Hi, this is Brian. Welcome to The Philosopher's Notes on Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity by Peter Attia, MD. As always, let's kick it off with a quote. Why does the world need another book about longevity? I've asked myself that question often over the last few years. This is how I see my role. I am not a laboratory scientist or a clinical researcher, but more of a translator, helping you understand and apply these insights. My approach to longevity is firmly rooted in science, but there is also a good deal of art in figuring out how and when to apply our knowledge to you, the patient, with your specific genes, your history and habits, and your goals. I believe that we already know more than enough to bend the curve. That is why this book is called Outlive. I mean it in both senses of the word. Live longer and better. My goal is to create an actionable operating manual for the practice of longevity, a guide that will help you outlive. I hope to convince you that with enough time and effort, you can potentially extend your lifespan by a decade and your health span possibly by two, meaning you might hope to function like someone 20 years younger than you. But my intent is not to tell you exactly what to do. It's to help you learn how to think about doing these things. More broadly, longevity demands a paradigm-shifting approach to medicine, one that directs our efforts towards preventing chronic diseases and improving our health span, and doing it now rather than waiting until disease has taken hold or until our cognitive and physical function has already declined. It's not preventive medicine, it's proactive medicine, and I believe it has the potential to not only change the lives of individuals, but also to relieve vast amounts of suffering in our society as a whole. This change is not coming from the medical establishment either. It will happen only if and when patients and physicians demand it. End quote. That is Peter Attia, MD, from Outlive. As per the back cover of the book, Peter Attia, MD, is the founder of Early Medical. He received his medical degree from Stanford University School of Medicine and trained at Johns Hopkins Hospital in general surgery. He also trained at the NIH as a surgical oncology fellow at the National Cancer Institute, where his research focused on immune-based therapies for melanoma. He serves on the editorial board for the journal Aging and is the host of the popular podcast, The Drive. As per my take on him, Attia is one of the most credible, grounded, practical, and inspiring authorities on the art and science of longevity. Now, I got this book as part of my recent micro sabbatical, in which I unplugged for a month and enjoyed going deep, reading 15 plus books on a couple of subjects, peak performance and energy. On the energy side of things, I read this book along with Georgia Eads' Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, Gabrielle Lyon's Forever Strong, Casey Means' Good Energy, and Robert Lustig's Metabolical, plus Johan Hari's Stolen Focus and Michael Easter's Scarcity Brain. The book is fantastic. It's been life-changing for me. I'm recommending it to all of my friends, and I think you'll love it, and I'm very confident it will be life-changing and almost certainly life-extending for you as well. As you'd expect, it's packed with big ideas. Technically, this one is absurdly packed with big ideas and will barely scratch the surface of its wisdom, but I'm excited to share a handful of my favorite ideas, so let's get to work. First, big idea, medicine 3.0. During my stint away from medicine, I realized that my colleagues and I had been trained to solve problems of an earlier era, the acute illness and injuries that medicine 2.0 had evolved to treat. I believe we need a new way of thinking about chronic diseases, their treatment, and how to maintain long-term health. The goal of this new medicine, which I call Medicine 3.0, is not to patch people up and get them out the door, removing their tumors and hoping for the best, but rather to prevent the tumors from appearing and spreading in the first place, or to avoid that first heart attack, or to divert someone from the path of Alzheimer's disease. Our treatments and our prevention and detection strategies need to change to fit the nature of these diseases with their long, slow prologues. End quote. Now, the book has three parts. In part one, Atiyah walks us through the evolution of healthcare and maps out the high-level objectives, strategy, and tactics for the book. In part two, he walks us through what the longest-lived people have in common and the top three challenges we face in our quest to outlive: heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's. In part three, we get into the practical tactics for our plan to live longer and better, including exercise, Atiyah's number one recommendation for longevity, nutrition, more specifically, nutritional biochemistry, sleep, learn to love it, it's the best medicine for your brain, and our emotional well-being and the high price of ignoring it. Now, that passage is from the second chapter in part one called Medicine 3.0, Rethinking Medicine for the Age of Chronic Disease. Here's the quick overview of Medicine 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. Atiyah tells us that the first era, exemplified by Hippocrates, but lasting almost 2,000 years after his death, is what I call Medicine 1.0. Its conclusions were based on direct observation and abetted more or less by pure guesswork, some of which was on target and some not so much. Then we have Medicine 2.0, which he says arrived in the mid-19th century with the advent of the germ theory of disease, which supplanted the idea that most illness was spread by miasmas or bad air. This led to improved sanitary practices by physicians and ultimately the development of antibiotics. He says, although Medicine 2.0 is transformational in many ways, it has proved far less successful against long-term diseases such as cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. Now, there are four primary distinctions between 2.0 and 3.0. First, he says, Medicine 3.0 places a far greater emphasis on prevention than treatment. Second, Medicine 3.0 considers the patient as a unique individual. Third, in Medicine 3.0, our starting point is the honest assessment and acceptance of risk, including the risk of doing nothing. Fourth, perhaps the largest shift is that where Medicine 2.0 focuses largely on lifespan and is almost entirely geared toward staving off death, Medicine 3.0 pays far more attention to maintaining health span, the quality of life. Then he brings it all together at the very end of the chapter when he tells us, and I quote him again, which brings us to perhaps the most important difference between Medicine 2.0 and Medicine 3.0. In Medicine 2.0, you are a passenger on the ship, being carried along somewhat passively. Medicine 3.0 demands much more from you, the patient. You must be well-informed, medically literate to a reasonable degree, clear-eyed about your goals, and cognizant of the true nature of risk. You must be willing to change ingrained habits, accept new challenges, and venture outside of your comfort zone if necessary. You are always participating, never passive. You confront problems, even uncomfortable or scary ones, rather than ignoring them until it's too late. You have skin in the game in a very literal sense, and you make important decisions because in this scenario, you are no longer a passenger on the ship. You are the captain. Next big idea, cancer metabolism. Quote, as you might have gathered by now, we tend to think of cancer as primarily a genetic disease driven by mutations of unknown cause. Clearly, cancer cells are genetically distinct from normal human cells. But for the last century or so, a handful of researchers have been investigating another unique property of cancer cells, and that is their metabolism. In the 1920s, a German physiologist named Otto Warburg discovered that cancer cells had a strangely gluttonous appetite for glucose, devouring it at up to 40 times the rate of healthy tissues. But these cancer cells weren't respiring the way normal cells do, consuming oxygen and producing lots of ATP, the energy currency of the cell, via the mitochondria. Rather, they appeared to be using a different pathway that cells normally use to produce energy under anaerobic conditions, meaning without sufficient oxygen, such as when we are sprinting. The strange thing was that these cancer cells were resorting to this inefficient metabolic pathway despite having plenty of oxygen available to them. Now, this struck Warburg as a very strange choice. In normal aerobic respiration, a cell can turn one molecule of glucose into as many as 36 units of ATP. But under anaerobic conditions, that same amount of glucose yields only 2 net units of ATP. This phenomenon was dubbed the Warburg effect, and even today, one way to locate potential tumors is by injecting the patient with radioactively labeled glucose and then doing a PET scan to see where most of the glucose is migrating. Areas with abnormally high glucose concentrations indicate the possible presence of a tumor. Warburg was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1931 for his discovery of a crucial enzyme in the electron transport chain, a key mechanism for producing energy in a cell. By the time he died in 1970, the weird quirk of cancer metabolism that he had discovered had been all but forgotten. The discovery of the structure of DNA by James Watson, Francis Crick, Maurice Wilkins, and Rosalind Franklin in 1953 had caused a seismic shift, not just in cancer research, but in biology in general. End quote. Now that's from a chapter called The Runaway Cell, in part two, in which Atiyah walks us through the leading killers of humanity and what they have in common. The hyper-abridged, oversimplified summary: all of the chronic diseases killing us that Medicine 2.0 does a very poor job of addressing are related to metabolic dysfunction. And for the record, here's how Atiyah defines metabolic dysfunction. Today, we call this cluster of problems metabolic syndrome, or MetSyn, and it is defined in terms of the following 5 criteria. Number 1, high blood pressure, 130 over 85, greater than 130 over 85. Number 2, high triglycerides, greater than 150 milligrams per deciliter. Number 3, low HDL cholesterol, less than 40 milligrams deciliter in men or less than 50 milligrams per deciliter in women. And number 4, central adiposity, waist circumference greater than 40 inches in men or greater than 35 in women. And number 5, elevated fasting glucose greater than 110 milligrams per deciliter. He says, if you meet 3 or more of these criteria, then you have the metabolic syndrome, along with as many as 120 million other Americans, according to a 2020 article in JAMA. About 90% of the U.S. population ticks at least one of those boxes. Quick check-in, how are you doing with those numbers? Click rewind about 30 seconds to listen to them again and do your checklist. Now, I pulled out that particular passage regarding cancer's preferential metabolism of glucose because it struck a nerve. As you know, if you've been following along, my brother died of pancreatic cancer several years ago. Immediately after he had an emergency surgery and was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, I immersed myself in the literature to support him. In the process, I created notes on some of the leading books on the subject, including The Metabolic Approach to Cancer by Nasha Winters, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease by Thomas Seyfried, Keto for Cancer by Miriam Kalemium, and Tripping Over the Truth by Travis Christofferson. I also created classes called Conquering Cancer 101 and Conquering Cancer 102. Check out all those notes and the classes linked in this PDF and in the app. And I wrote a note on the mainstream book on cancer by one of Medicine 2.0's leading thinkers, Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of All Maladies. In that note, I came as close to being rude and belligerent as I have ever gotten in a note. Why? Because in his 592-page book, which is considered the best book on cancer by Medicine 2.0, he didn't mention Otto Warburg and his theories on metabolism, not even a single reference. Now, it was infuriating for me when I read it. Almost as infuriating as going to my brother's oncology appointment with him to get a PET scan, which, as Atiyah points out, measures hot spots of glucose metabolism to identify potential cancerous tumors that preferentially feast on glucose, and seeing a candy bowl at the reception desk. They were feeding my brother the very food that would feed his cancer and had no idea that was a bad idea. Then there was the Pancreatic Cancer Society's walkathon fundraising event I went to that was sponsored by a fast food restaurant. Free soda and hot dogs were served, and beach balls with their logo were handed out to kids and adults alike. And to be blunt, that is all crazy, which is why I was very happy Atiya talks about this and also mentions a chat in which he talked to Mukherjee. Apparently, he has evolved his thinking and is now pursuing metabolic solutions to cancer. Little PS here, the way I tried to help my brother be the captain of his ship rather than a mere passenger as he navigated his cancer treatment was to encourage him to see himself less as a patient, which literally means one who submits, and more as a conqueror, which literally means one who seeks successfully. Next big idea, exercise, the number one tactic. Quote, more than any other tactical domain we discuss in this book, exercise has the greatest power to determine how you will live out the rest of your life. There are reams of data supporting the notion that even a fairly minimal amount of exercise can lengthen your life by several years. It delays the onset of chronic diseases pretty much across the board. But it is also amazingly effective at extending and improving health span. Not only does it reverse physical decline, which I suppose is somewhat obvious, but it can slow or reverse cognitive decline as well. So if you adopt only one new set of habits based on reading this book, it must be in the realm of exercise. If you currently exercise, you will likely want to rethink and modify your program. And if exercise is not a part of your life at the moment, you are not alone. 77% of the U.S. population is like you. Now is the time to change that. Right now, even a little bit of daily activity is much better than nothing. Going from zero weekly exercise to just 90 minutes per week can reduce your risk of dying from all causes by 14%. It's very hard to find anything that can do that. End quote. Now that's from the first practical chapter in part three. Once we've established the high-level intellectual framework, Medicine 3.0, and clarified our objectives and strategies to optimize our metabolism and mitochondria to increase both our lifespan and our health span, we get to work on the tactics that will enable us to succeed. Atiya tells us we want to dominate the same core fundamentals we come back to all the time, eating, moving, and sleeping. But he tells us the place to start is with exercise. I'm going to repeat this line. So if you adopt only one new set of habits based on reading this book, it must be in the realm of exercise. Now, Atiya italicized must. I just put it in all caps, bold italic, just to make sure you got the memo. And I want to emphasize that Atiya isn't a biohacking nut. He's a relatively conservative and very rigorous thinking Stanford-trained medical doctor. So I personally took him at his word and have re-architected my training protocol to meet his standards. The biggest shift for me, zone 2 training. Although my VO2 max, I got it tested immediately after reading his book, was in the highest or superior category for my age, I guess the 101 burpees, 1,000 meters of rowing, and 10,000 steps a day every day for a decade have helped, I was only getting about an hour of zone 2 in per week. Frankly, I was seeing how little I could train to feel great. But I wasn't even hitting the standard American recommendation of 150 minutes or 2.5 hours per week of zone 2. Atiya recommends 3 to 4 hours per week. I can assure you I hit 3 hours the week I read the book, and I've hit 4 hours in the 3 weeks since I read the book and created this note, and I have hit 4 hours every week that I'm not traveling since then. I have a 3-hour floor that I use as kind of my floor to hit on travel weeks for my days a little bit out of the bubble wrap, shall we say. Otherwise, it's 4 hours a week. Now, Atiya says this about zone 2, which is 60 to 70% of your max. You can figure out your max by taking your 220 minus your age. That's your max. Then times it by 60% to get your floor for zone 2. And then by 70% to know the range and upper threshold for zone 2. So Atiya says, I am so persuaded of the benefits of zone 2 that it has become a cornerstone of my training plan. 4 times a week, I will spend an hour riding my stationary bike at my zone 2 threshold. For me, it's my trail and rowing. Now, in addition to strength and stability training as part of our new exercise protocol, he's all about optimizing our VO2 max, which is why hitting a standard is my current number one energy goal. He tells us, I push my patients to train for as high a VO2 max as possible so that they can maintain a high level of physical function as they age. Ideally, I want them to target the elite range for their age and sex, roughly the top 2%. If they achieve that level, I say, good job. Now let's reach for the elite level for your sex, but two decades younger. This may seem like an extreme goal, but I like to aim high, in case you haven't noticed. End quote. Guess what my goal is? Yep, probably in the top 5 to 10% VO2 max now. Time to get in the top 2%, then drop it by a couple of decades. How about you? Next big idea, protein, the essential building blocks of life. Quote, why is protein important? One clue lies in the name, which is derived from the Greek word proteos, which means primary. Protein and amino acids are the essential building blocks of life. Without them, we simply cannot build or maintain the lean muscle mass we need. The first thing you need to know about protein is that the standard recommendations for daily consumption are, and I quote, a joke. Right now, the U.S. recommended dietary allowance, or RDA, for protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. This may reflect how much protein we need to stay alive, but it is a far cry from what we need to thrive. How much protein do we actually need? It varies from person to person. In my patients, I typically set 1.6 grams per kilogram per day as the minimum, which is twice the RDA. The ideal amount can vary from person to person, but the data suggest that for active people with normal kidney function, 1 gram per pound of body weight per day, or 2.2 grams per kilogram per day, is a good place to start, nearly triple the minimal recommendation, end quote. Now, as you might have guessed, that's from the chapter on nutrition. I'm going to skip the details on this chat and encourage you to check out the notes on Gabrielle Lyon's Forever Strong for more wisdom on the subject. For now, remember, high-quality protein, about 1 gram per pound per day, does a hero good. How much are you having? P.S., Atiya says, in case my point here isn't clear enough, let me restate it. Don't ignore protein. It's the one macronutrient that is absolutely essential to our goals. There's no minimum requirement for carbohydrates or fats in practical terms, but if you shortchange protein, you will most certainly pay a price, particularly as you age, end quote. Next and final big idea, sleep. Get some or else. Quote, we need to sleep about 7.5 to 8.5 hours a night. There's even some evidence from studies conducted in dark caves that our 8-ish hour sleep cycle may be hardwired to some extent, suggesting that this requirement is non-negotiable. Even a single night of bad sleep has been found to have deleterious effects on our physical and cognitive performance. Athletes who sleep poorly the night before a race or a match perform markedly worse than when they are more well-rested. Endurance drops, VO2 max drops, and one rep max strength drops, and we are more likely to be injured. A 2014 observational study found that young athletes who slept less than 6 hours per night were more than 2.5 times more likely to experience an injury than their peers who slept 8 hours or more. Good sleep is like a performance-enhancing drug, end quote. Sleep, it does a hero good. Right after that passage, Atiya references the same Stanford study we talk about in our notes on Arianna Huffington's The Sleep Revolution. Then he talks about how LeBron James, quote, makes sleep a key part of his recovery routine, always trying for 9 and sometimes 10 hours of sleep per night, plus a daily nap. And let's be really clear here. We're talking about sleep, not time in bed. If you're 90% efficient, meaning you get sleep in 90% of the time you're in bed, that's great. But if you're in bed for 10 hours, that means you're getting about 9 hours of sleep. If you're in bed for 7 hours, there's no way you're getting 7 hours of sleep, let alone the minimum 7.5. So when you do the math on how much sleep you're getting and need, and you're not using a Fitbit or an Oura Ring or Whoop or whatever, make sure you're accounting for the efficiency in spending enough time in bed to get the requisite sleep Back to the note. Atiyah also tells us, yet we are often unaware of the devastating effect that poor sleep is having on our energy levels and our performance. Research has found that people who are sleep deprived almost always underestimate its effects on them because they adapt to it. We come to accept the resulting state of mild exhaustion and mental fog as a new normal, a process called baseline resetting. It's like a regular TV looks fine if that's all you've ever seen, but once you see a 4K screen, you realize that your old cathode ray tube TV was not very clear at all. The difference is that dramatic. And that's how we'll wrap up this super quick look at this great book. How's your metaphorical TV resolution? Here's to dialing up to heroic levels as we dominate the fundamentals, as we optimize our lifespan and our health span while showing up with all the energy we need in our work and our love today. Outlive, the science and art of longevity. Peter Atiyah, MD, thank you, sir. Let's enjoy some great quotes from the sidebar, then we'll wrap it up. Bishop Desmond Tutu once said, there comes a point where we need to stop just pulling people out of the river. We need to go upstream and find out why they're falling in. Atiyah shares that quote in the context of talking about medicine 2.0 and 3.0. We got to be more proactive. We've got to figure out how we can extend not just the lifespan, but the health span. Lifespan is how long you live. Health span is how long you feel great while you're living. Who cares if you get an extra decade if you're immobilized and in pain and all that good stuff? We want our health span and our lifespan to go out together. Now, Atiyah tells us, as we just discussed, I quote, longevity has two components. The first is how long you live, your chronological lifespan, but the second and equally important part is how well you live, the quality of your years. This is called health span. John F. Kennedy says, the time to repair the roof is when the sun is shining. Muhammad Ali said, I never won in the ring, I always won in preparation. Sun Tzu said, strategy without tactics is the slowest route to victory. Tactics without strategy is the noise before defeat. Strategy drives tactics. Bruce Lee said, absorb what is useful, discard what is useless, and add what is specifically your own. Dr. Atiyah, who tells us, the conundrum we face is that our environment has changed dramatically over the last century or two in almost every imaginable way. Our food supply and eating habits, our activity levels, and the structure of our social networks, while our genes have scarcely changed at all. Longevity may be a game of inches where relatively small interventions with cumulative effect could help us replicate the centenarian's lifespan and health span. Put another way, if we want to outlive our life expectancy and live better longer, we will have to work hard to earn it through small incremental changes. Or as we like to say, it's the tiny little optimizations, the marginal gains aggregated and compounded over an extended period of time that make a huge difference. Atiyah tells us, it turns out that peak aerobic cardiorespiratory fitness, measured in terms of VO2 max, is perhaps the single most powerful marker for longevity. That's a big deal. VO2 max. What's yours? By the way, separately, as we talk about a lot in our Heroic Coach certification, the number one data point that will reveal to your doctor and to you whether or not you have metabolic dysfunction is your waist-to-height ratio. We want our waist-to-height ratio to be less than 0.5. That's going to help us determine whether or not we have all the visceral fat around our belly. It's going to be problematic. For example, I am 6 feet tall. That's 72 inches. I can have a waist that is 36 inches wide, and I'd be at 0.5. Mine is considerably less than 36 inches. How about you? Waist to height, get it less than 0.5. And remember, your VO2 max is perhaps the single most powerful marker for longevity. Do you know your VO2 max? I didn't until a few months ago. Let's go. Back to Atiyah. The fittest people had the lowest mortality rates by a surprising margin. This study found that someone of below average VO2 max for their age and sex, that is, between the 25th and 50th percentiles, is at double the risk of all-cause mortality compared to someone in the top quartile, 75th to 97th percentile. He tells us that poor cardiorespiratory fitness carries a greater relative risk of death than smoking. Sir John Templeton tells us it is impossible to produce superior performance unless you do something different from the majority. Thomas A. Kempis once said, "The loftier the building, the deeper the foundation must be laid." Back to Atiyah, who tells us, "If there is one type of food that I would eliminate from everyone's diet if I could, it would be fructose-sweetened drinks, including both sodas and fruit juices, which deliver too much fructose too quickly to a gut and liver that much prefer to process fructose slowly. Just eat fruit and let nature provide the right amount of fiber and water." One type of food, remember, the sugary drinks. It's heroic food rule number one. Again, in our coaching program, don't drink sugar. Do you? Do your kids, even more importantly? Don't drink sugar. It's not benign. Back to Atiyah. The healthier and more efficient your mitochondria, the greater your ability to utilize fat, which is by far the body's most efficient and abundant fuel source. This ability to use both fuels, fat and glucose, is called metabolic flexibility. And finally, he tells us, there's a quote from Paulo Coelho that I think about often. "Maybe the journey isn't so much about becoming anything," he writes. "Maybe it's about unbecoming everything that isn't really you, so you can be who you were meant to be in the first place." That is a very quick look at this great book, Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity, Peter Atiyah, MD. Thank you again, sir. If you enjoyed the note, I think you will also enjoy the notes on the recent books we featured, including Forever Strong, Good Energy, and my new all-time favorite nutrition book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind. Check that out by Dr. Georgia Ead. And most importantly, as always, what was the idea that most jumped out and landed for you? And what can you do today, right now, to do something about it? How can you move from theory to practice to mastery and make this wisdom a deeper part of your day-to-day life? Think about that. Get on that. Make today another great day. Here's to extending those day ones, feeling great, increasing both our lifespan and our health span starting today.
We hope you enjoyed that philosopher's note. Go to heroic.us to download more.